Welcome to Let's Talk About It, co-hosted by Maria Wyatt and Scott Dudley. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.
Good morning, Imperial Valley. You are listening to your weekly wellness radio, Let's Talk About It, with your host, Scott Dudley, and yours truly, Maria Wyatt. We are brought to you by Imperial County Behavioral Health and KUBO 88.7 Radio Bilingue. Our phone number here at the station is 337-8874, and also you can access this show and previous shows. We have a long list at kxoradio.com.
Yes, indeed we can. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Good.
Good. It's going to be a great show today. I'm excited because all things, really, because if you look at the last 5 to 10 years of behavioral health development, if you will, we really tried to put an emphasis on finding strong, grounded, evidence-based techniques and principles and therapies that work for specific groups of people and plug those in and make those an everyday thing, an everyday part of our operations here to specifically deal with problems in specific ways for specific outcomes. And our guest today is the guy behind the curtain. It's the person who works for the California Institute of Mental Health, and he's the deputy director there. And, you know, he's done a lot of things at the kind of the state level for mental health along the way, systems of care and some other things. Dr. Todd Cessna, and we are pleased to have him here today, literally almost by phone, and talk about all of the great programming stuff, not only the great programming stuff, but maybe a little bit of what's in store for mental health in California as we move forward into healthcare stuff. Okay.
Good morning, Todd.
Good morning.
There you are. How are you?
I am good. It's a pleasure to join you both on the show this morning.
Welcome aboard.
Welcome, welcome. And, you know, you're recorded now forever. You're going to be on the Internet. It's going to be memorialized for centuries to come.
You can do audio resumes as you work your way through whatever organizational ladder you need to.
Well, let's start from the beginning. California Institute of Mental Health, what is it and what is the purpose?
Sure. So the California Institute of Mental Health goes by the acronym CIMH, is a Sacramento-based statewide mental health training center. We were established a little over 15 years ago by the California Mental Health Directors Association. So there are 58 counties in California. Every county, like Imperial County, has a behavioral health program, and their directors have an association, and they established our agency to help provide training so that county mental health programs could remain current. And so we promote excellence in public mental health through training and technical assistance, research, and policy.
Nice, and help us to remain current. Were we all, like, in the same place 15 years ago when this all started? All 58 counties, that is?
It's hard to say. I've been with the agency for 11 years, so I can go back that far. And there's been a tremendous amount of change in California's mental health system over those 11 years, including the formations of the mental health plans for individuals with Cal, and the Mental Health Services Act, which included services for individuals with more severe and persistent needs, full service partnership programs, and for people with early signs of difficulty under prevention and early intervention. And across the 58 counties, some of which are very urban and some of which are small and rural, there's actually quite a bit of variability in terms of the needs of those communities, the kinds of programs they prioritize, the cultural diversity of the population. So a great deal of variability across the program that you see in each of those counties.
And so the California Institute of Mental Health isn't kind of with its eye on a one-size-fits-all version of mental health for California, but just in terms of matching needs with public policy, with regional variances, with population variances, et cetera, right, more or less?
That's exactly right. And you can imagine anyone who's traveled in California knows that, you know, there's a great difference between Humboldt County or Del Norte, border Oregon, the Bay Area, you know, the Central Valley, Los Angeles, San Diego, Orange County, and then, you know, yourselves, San Bernardino and Riverside, with large, you know, desert areas and populations that are spread out over large areas.
And keeping in mind with that there's so much diversity among California and among the counties. A couple of years ago, CIMH, California Institute of Mental Health, came down to Imperial County. And, you know, we got together, that means Department of Social Services, Probation Department, Behavioral Health, and I don't recall if Imperial County Office of Education was there also. I think they were. And, you know, they looked at our population. CIMH looked at our population and our at-risk youth, and they gave us, you know, all these evidence-based programs to implement. And out of those, you know, we came up with functional family therapy. We have the multidimensional treatment, foster care, and the
trauma-focused
CBT.
Yes.
So, and it's because, you know, CIMH came down and, you know, they showed us the programs and, you know, told us about it.
They said your shoe size is 7.5, and would
yes.
you like to try something on in a pump or a heel?
Yes.
Basically.
Basically.
Were you part of that? Were you part of that, Todd? That when we came down and kind of worked with us?
Yeah, I've had the pleasure of working with Imperial County Behavioral Health, and as Maria points out, Imperial County uses a systems of care approach, so the collaboration with social services and with probation, with schools, and also importantly with families and youth themselves, and looked at some of the areas of significant need and looked for the evidence-based practices, the intervention models that have the strongest demonstrated effectiveness for the kinds of needs that are prominent in Imperial County and also in a number of other counties. And the models that Rhea mentioned are among some of the most effective intervention models for children. And Imperial County has actually been asked about, you know, variation across counties. Imperial County has been one of the leaders in implementing evidence-based practices. And so their interest in doing so, starting years ago, dedicating the staff not only to learning the models, but to ensuring that they're done well over time so that these models continue to remain effective, requires training and oversight, has been a priority for Imperial County and puts Imperial County among the small number of counties that moved in this direction early.
Do you think there's a benefit for counties to go in that direction? I mean, what do you ultimately see as the payoff for committing to kind of these evidence-based things that require some investment in terms of time and training and money, et cetera?
It does require, an investment in time and money and in resources in developing in the organization the resources to really monitor and support this. And I have a couple of thoughts. One is the primary benefit is kids and families, and there are also practices for adults with mental health difficulties, simply get, you know, more effective outcomes. They achieve their goals sooner, and they maintain those benefits longer. So these evidence-based practices have been sort of developed over years, sometimes over decades, and proven themselves to be more effective treatments for mental health disorders. So the primary benefit is that people get better outcomes. In the long term, all the counties are going to have to move this direction. Perhaps we'll get an opportunity to talk at greater length about health care reform. But one of the things that's in the national health care reform legislation is a very strong emphasis on what's referred to as evidence-based medicine, which for mental health would be the very evidence-based practices we're talking about. And in our health care, it's routine now. You expect when you go and you see your doctor for a health problem, whether it's a cardiac issue or some other kind of cancer treatment, you're expecting your physician to be current on the research and using the most effective and most proven medications, surgical techniques, treatment models. And so it's no different in mental health. And the practices that Imperial County is implementing would be those kinds of interventions proven to be effective.
Todd, with evidence-based, it's kind of, you hear that thrown around a lot now. Is it easier said than done? And what really constitutes evidence-based said versus evidence-based done?
Yeah.
So that's a very excellent question, because nowadays with healthcare reform and with states and counties giving a priority to evidence-based practices, everyone now wants to represent what they do as evidence-based. This kind of reminds me of how food products, change their labeling so that the folks think that the food is perhaps, organic or healthy, and so there's all these different kinds of words on food labeling, and it can be very difficult, from the consumer's perspective to figure out what's really in the food I'm buying and is it really, more healthy than other foods. It's the same kind of an issue with evidence-based practices. And it is a little, it would take, the average consumer would have to do a fair amount of exploring right now to try to discern what is evidence-based and what is not. The underlying difference is the research that's been done to show that practice is really effective. Mm-hmm. And I think that the best example might be what we do with pharmaceuticals. So everyone, I think, is familiar with double-blind studies where, some patients get the active medication and some patients get a placebo.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that gives us confidence that the active medication is really effective. There are similar kinds of studies for mental health treatments, and when those studies are conducted, they're rigorous, and the results show that the intervention is more effective. We call it evidence-based.
Now, when you've got pharmacies, you've got formularies, and you've got chemical formulas, and you've got some sort of quality control to ensure that this chemical and that chemical, if they're called the same thing, are the same thing. How do you manage to do that with people and practices in evidence-based with mental health?
So this very same emphasis on what we call model adherence or fidelity that you're referring to in terms of quality of pharmaceutical. So there are training protocols, not just in-person training, but supervision and coaching. There are measures of how closely a therapist or a practitioner adheres to the protocol, uses the treatment as intended. And then their outcome evaluation, so that we can verify that in your county, you're getting the very same kind of outcomes that have been reported nationally. And it's really great that I'm in a position to say that Imperial County has done all these things. So the three intervention models that Maria mentioned earlier, Imperial County in each case has gotten very rigorous training. That sometimes involves multiple in-person events, phone consultation, monitoring of fidelity that occurs over a year or longer, and Imperial County collects outcome data that's routinely analyzed and reported to show that their programs are performing as you would expect a program of high quality to perform.
So when we get a guest on here and they're talking about, let's say, like functional family therapy, for instance, and they're calling it evidence-based and they're saying that they're doing it, there's actually a lot behind those words in terms of making sure that there's some product integrity, I suppose.
That is absolutely correct. And FFT is a good model, functional family therapy, which is an evidence-based intervention for families where there are kids, teenagers, conflict or disruptive behavior, conduct problems, kids who are involved with probation, and families who are involved with child welfare systems all benefit from FFT. Enhances a family's ability to resolve its own difficulties in a positive way and to avoid involvement with patients and to avoid maltreatment, child abuse kinds of situations. And there's a national training center. There's a very rigorous training protocol. It involves no less than 4 in-person trainings and weekly consultation for a year. It involves use of a very elaborate process for helping the practitioners remain consistent in their use of the model with integrity in the way you described, and it includes routine evaluation of family outcomes. So it is quite rigorous and certified sites, and Imperial has a certified site. Our sites that demonstrate integrity to the model and demonstrate that the model is achieving improvement in family outcomes.
Very cool. Now, in functional family therapy, then, is for, it targets youth, but it also targets families.
Family.
I think all of us that are in human services experience kind of this cross-generational, intergenerational difficulty getting it together. Does this kind of address that?
Yeah, so the functional family therapy, the model, really sees child behavior difficulties as best resolved within the context of the family, and really sees the role of the therapist as enhancing the family's capacity to be successful.
To function.
To function, yeah. Exactly. And really sees the real active ingredient as the family and the therapist really being a catalyst for change. It's a brief intervention. On average, it's about 15 sessions. That's all it takes. It's for families where there is a youth, so a child who's 11 or older, who's having some kind of behavior problem in school, or as severe as being on probation. It's also successful with families who are involved in child welfare system, or where there's early signs of conflict in the home, arguing and lack of cooperation and folks beginning to not get along, which might be the early signs of more serious difficulty. And it restores family relationships. It enhances problem-solving skills. And simply prepares the family to be better able to resolve its own difficulties. And when the family functions better, not surprisingly, children behave better. It focuses less on how you got to the difficulties and focuses more on how to enhance family functioning and prepare them to be more successful as a family going forward.
Yeah, and I noticed it just jumped right off at me that, you know, typically, I guess, I would expect maybe a diagnosis to be thrown around. Well, this is for kids with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or this is for oppositional defiant kids, or this is for depressed people, or whatever, and you didn't really go there, did you?
No, and I think that for a couple of reasons, diagnosing folks is, of course, a reality in the way in which our health system funds us. So the way insurance companies work, the way Medi-Cal works, diagnoses are a reality. In order to get payment, the insurance company wants to know that the individual is being treated for a disorder.
It's like pass and go in Monopoly.
Exactly. Yeah. So, in fact, kids who get functional family therapy or any of the other mental health treatments, because of this sort of reality of how we fund our mental health systems and how insurance companies work, we'll probably have a diagnosis. However, when it comes to describing the relevance of the intervention model, I don't know that the diagnosis is a sufficient sort of and helpful way of characterizing what occurs. So FFT is suitable for a very broad range of difficulties that kids and families experience, and that would cover a broad range of diagnostic categories. The other thing that's really relevant here is that diagnoses tend to really focus individual need, and functional family therapy as a family therapy model focuses on family and really sees the family as the principal solution to the difficulties that individual family members experience. And I think that that's a model that resonates with our own personal experience, which is family defined very broadly. You know, people live in families, rely upon families, and oftentimes succeed because of their families. And so, although diagnosis is a reality in terms of understanding how these evidence-based systems work, what's more important is understanding the focus, what the focus of the intervention is. And the focus of FFT is really restoring families where conflict has begun to cause difficulty within the family structure and, in turn, resultant behavior that's problematic for individuals within the family.
Yes.
FFT sounds mm-hmm. like a really broad and somewhat flexible puzzle piece, if you will, in kind of constructing a system that really kind of meets everyone's needs. Does it run the risk of being too much one size fits all, or is it really designed to be able to handle a variety of different needs, but there are certain types of people that really wouldn't be inclined to have this for an intervention?
So your question is, I think, quite good. FFT is highly individualized in the sense that the model speaks to general strategies, but when applying it to any one family, you would take into account the particular needs, culture, values, beliefs, and there have actually been studies that have documented the way in which FFT conforms to the specific circumstances of a family. So in that regard, it is highly flexible. In terms of, you know, where you would use FFT, FFT would be simple if you were talking about addressing the needs of a child who was 11 or 12 and older. So it's largely mm-hmm. for junior high and high school aged kids, and where the primary focus is conflict in the home, disruptive behavior, conduct difficulties, acting out, substance use, whether it's early signs, so just in the beginning of family conflict, whether there's been maltreatment and the family's come to the attention of child welfare, or where there's been a law violation and the youth is now on probation. Under all of those circumstances, FFT would be suitable, and what you see that's common there is family conflict, conduct, and disruptive problems. If you had a child where the primary focus was trauma, for example, then you would want to use a different intervention, like the trauma-focused cognitive behavior therapy. But when disruptive disorder is the primary focus, FFT is suitable.
And it's in functional family therapy, it's one of those models that, you know, the clinician goes and has to do. It's every family is so different from each other, and what might work for one family does not work for the other. And it's that's the way this family functions, and the other family might function differently. And it's flexible, but also individualized.
And you make an excellent point, Maria, because in some forms of what we might call family therapy, there's an expectation that there's a certain way families should function.
That's right, yeah.
And structure, and that all families should be the same way, as if, you know, everyone should be, you know, a model family with a certain structure and a certain hierarchy. In the functional family therapy model, there is no preconceived structure that's considered optimal. There's a recognition that you have two-parent homes and you have one-parent homes. You have kids with grandparents, and kids with mixed generation caregivers, and a variety of circumstances, and that the structure of those families varies, and that it's not the goal of the FFT therapist to change the structure. It's the goal of the FFT therapist to understand the structure and to help the family make it successful. So essentially, FFT believes that there's more than one way to skin a cat, and that there are many ways to be successful, and that the best way to be successful is to build on the strengths of the family, not to try to make people all do the same, you know, be successful in the same way.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like FFT's kind of like a pizzeria, and families are like pizzas. There's like square pans, there's round pans, there's thin crust, there's thick crust, there's extra sauce, and really it's just kind of sitting down and figuring out what type of pizza that family wants to have something that's, you know, delicious and nutritious and meets that family's needs.
That's exactly right. And you have families who, you know, who might be lactose intolerant. And
there you go.
Cheese, and you got another family who's not going to eat gluten, and you're going to have to find a substitute for the pizza dough. Mm-hmm. And FFT makes accommodation for all those circumstances because it fundamentally believes that your best way of achieving a good outcome is by building upon the strengths of each individual and each family, and that every individual and every family has strengths, and that by building on those, your outcomes are most likely to be sustainable because you're building on the roots of the individual, you know. You're building on what's core to them, and that is part of what makes an evidence-based practice.
Nice. You know, we're here with Todd Cessna. He's the Deputy Director of the California Institute of Mental Health, Dr. Todd Cessna, dare I say. And we're coming right up on the top of the hour break, but Todd, if it's all right with you, we'll kind of take the break now, and then when we come back, we can talk a little bit more about a couple of other evidence-based programs the county has,
and then kind of
scurry off into healthcare reform and all the other stuff that's cooking right now.
Sounds good.
Okay, then we'll be right back. This is Let's Talk About It, your voice for wellness in Imperial Valley.
You're listening to the complete podcast version of Imperial County's Behavioral Health Service, Let's Talk About It, brought to you by KXORadio.com.
Welcome back. You're still listening to Let's Talk About It, your weekly wellness radio for Imperial and Mexicali Valley. We are brought to you by Imperial County Behavioral Health and KUBO 88.7 Radio Bilingüe. Our phone number here at the station is 337-8874, and also this show will be on our podcast at kxoradio.com. And we're here back with Scott and yours truly, Maria Wyatt, and our guest,
who is Dr. Todd Cessna, the Deputy Director of California Institute of Mental Health, calling live and direct from Sacramento. And you know, the good thing about the podcast is, as we were talking on the break, is that Mario actually makes us sound smarter on the podcast. So you thought we were good in person. Wait till the podcast comes out. Mario actually re-edits the words and combines them into things that actually make sense. Welcome back, Todd.
Oh, thank you.
We before the break, we were talking about FFT, one of the evidence-based programs that Imperial County Behavioral Health has implemented through ICMH. But we also have implemented trauma-focused CBT, and we've had it, actually, trauma-focused CBT, we've been having it for longer than FFT.
Trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, I recognized an acronym slipping in there.
Yes, true, sorry. What can you tell us a little bit about trauma-focused CBT or trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy?
Sure. So trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy is, like FFT, an evidence-based practice. It's been developed for kids who have experienced trauma, and it's used very broadly. So it has application for a whole variety of kinds of trauma, natural disasters, medical procedures, kids who witness violence, whether it be in their neighborhood or in their home, and for kids who have experienced some kind of a traumatic event in their own life, whether that might involve some kind of assault that they experienced, whether they it occurs within the context of a child abuse situation, and so it's been used very broadly. It was used following Katrina. Trauma-focused cognitive behavior therapists were brought in to work with kids. It was used following 9/11. It's been used internationally in sub-Sahara Africa and in Cambodia and in a variety of other contexts. And so it's proven to be very versatile. It's used for a whole variety of traumatic events. It's been used in a variety of different countries, a broad range of different cultural groups, used in a large number of different languages, and proven to be very helpful in resolving the impact of trauma on kids.
Connie's been doing that for several years now, huh? It's been a while.
At least 3 years, I think. 3 years. But, and it was used, actually, when we had the earthquake.
Yeah, we had a 7.2 earthquake, Dr. Sussna, and
last year.
Yeah.
Last April.
I recall hearing about that. One of the things about trauma that not everyone, I think, appreciates is that there are neurobiological changes that occur when trauma occurs. And that, among other things, there's a release of cortisol in our brains that affect sort of our reactions to things. We become hypervigilant, and we become sort of focused on potential threat, which makes sense following a traumatic event. But if that persists unresolved, it can become problematic for us. And in the case of kids, it can affect their school performance. It can affect their relationships with their peers and with adults. It can affect how they feel about themselves, their mood, their behavior, and can have significant consequences. Mm-hmm. And trauma-focused CBT helps kids and their parents resolve those difficulties so that those kinds of problems don't persist.
So it's like an alarm that just keeps going off at random times and totally distracting you from whatever you're trying to do day to day.
That is exactly right. That's an excellent way of describing it.
Oh, we also have, I think, what's it called,
Multidimensional treatment foster care.
Maria's been practicing her acronyms.
So you do. Multidimensional treatment foster care goes by the acronym MTFC. It's a very special kind of a practice that was developed and thoroughly researched for a very small group, relatively speaking, of kids who have very high needs. And MTFC was developed as an alternative to residential or group home treatment and for state hospitals or corrections programs. And so what happens often is when kids have the most severe kinds of behavioral difficulties, particularly those kids who are involved in child welfare system or in the probation system, and their behavior is difficult to manage, those kids sometimes get removed from their home, and if their behavior is too difficult for the typical foster parent or relative caregiver, they often end up in group homes. And the research on outcomes for kids who are in group homes shows that they don't always achieve the kinds of outcomes that we would hope, that group homes don't prepare kids to function as well as adults. And so multidimensional treatment foster care is an alternative to group homes. And it involves a very specially trained and selected foster parent who will end up having just one foster child in their home at a time. And then that child will receive very intensive mental health services. So it can kind of be thought of as a group home for one, as if a child were to have their very own personal group home. Has all the services and all the supports that you would find in a residential care, but the child lives in a foster home, attends regular school, and the outcomes are dramatically better. Less use of drugs, less difficult behavior, dramatic improvements in school performance, and more likely to return home and stay home.
And the one aspect of the MTFC is that there's someone on call 24 hours, 7, 24, 24/7, And, you know, if the foster parent has something happens in the middle of the night or late at night, they can always call the supervisor on call for this model, which is great.
That is true. There's a whole treatment team
that
works with every child and foster parent. The foster parent is specially trained. There's a program supervisor who's the individual who's on call 24/7. There's a family therapist, an individual therapist, a behavioral skills trainer. And so it's a very intensive program that addresses both needs of family, needs of foster family, needs of child, and prepares them all to be more successful in much the same way we've talked about in regards to the other programs, really building on strengths, building skills, building capacity for kids and families to be successful.
And I guess in comparison to standard traditional practices, which almost look like warehousing in comparison, dare I say, you're getting significantly better outcomes with this type of focused, managed intervention.
Yeah, so the interesting thing is MTSC is less expensive to provide. So for individuals who are concerned about stretching our public mental health dollar.
In these taxpayer-conscious days.
Yes, MTSC costs less and remarkably achieves dramatically better outcomes. So kids do better, families do better, and it costs less, in part because it's a smarter, more dynamic kind of a program, one child in one foster home. You're not paying for a building. You know, you're not paying for three shifts of staff that you would need to in a hospital or in a group home setting, you know, that work all hours of the day. You're really building on individual family-type homes, but you're providing all of the professional services that foster parent would need to really help that child be successful.
You know, can almost like paradoxically, because the system developed in this whole kind of interagency way traditionally, it almost becomes a little bit difficult to unravel, I would suspect. And then it may be hard just to kind of drop all of the practices that were built up and embrace something as redesigned, I suppose, as MTFC.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's funny you say that because I think that there's a reluctance for people to think that some of these programs that we're talking about, which actually end up being briefer and less expensive than what we're used to doing, are actually more effective. And I think part of the reason is that we tend to think that more is better. And what evidence-based practices are teaching us is that smarter is better.
Well, is better.
Well, in the past, and it's because of, you know, also healthcare reform and, you know, taxpayers, you know, the way the economy is. Sometimes people were in individual psychotherapy for years, you know, seeing their clinician, the therapist, for years, you know, 2, 3 years, 4 years, without any outcomes. With evidence-based, it's a model. You follow it. You know, you implement it. You get, you know, staff get trained. There's supervision. And there's also outcomes, positive outcomes.
And I think one of the, a couple of the things about these models that's noteworthy, they tend very much to build on individual and family strengths. And they tend really to see long-term outcomes being the result of teaching people new skills and building on family resources. And so rather than trying to have the system do everything for somebody, these models really look to help people do for themselves, help families meet their own needs. And when you partner with people in that way, they're carrying much of the weight of those outcomes. They're doing much of the work rather than thinking that the system must do all the work.
Well, and it sounds like this is really important moving forward because as we were kind of touching on healthcare reform, you know, we see the prevalence of mental health problems and we see, you know, not only the subtle effects of lost work time or failure to kind of maximally, you know, participate in the community as a consumer or whatever our goal as humans is. But we also see a lot of people with mental health problems ending up in prisons or ending up in other types of high-cost government interventions. And is healthcare reform going to help us to begin to address this in some sort of proactive, pro-social way?
The answer is yes. That's certainly one of its principal goals. It's interesting that you talk about sort of the impact of healthcare reform on, you know, on the costs and on people's lives. There was a study done called The Faces of Medicaid, and they looked at the cost of healthcare for Medi-Cal beneficiaries, and they found that 5% of the beneficiaries account for 50% of all of the Medicaid expenditures, which is to say a small number of people, almost always with multiple health disorders, are accounting for the large proportion of our healthcare costs in the Medicaid system. And interestingly, mental health disorders are very frequently part of that constellation. In other words, mental health is one of the multiple disorders. And when it's the case, the cost of healthcare goes up and health outcomes are jeopardized as well. And there was a recent study that's quite alarming that tells us that individual adults with serious mental illness have a life expectancy that's about 25 years lower than the average American. And if you add substance abuse to that, the person loses 5 more years. So that the average life expectancy for an individual with a mental health and a substance abuse disorder is 48 years. And so the consequences of healthcare reform, you know, are very real and very significant for people with mental health disorders, because it really focuses attention on coordinating health care and mental health care for individuals who have dual disorders so that both get the attention they need and you get improved well-being and extended life expectancy.
Now, we've kind of seen the legislation, I guess, in theory, and we kind of have a sense of, I guess, the current system as is with, you know, the caveat being that depending on how much money the state has, your service levels will move up and down a little bit with the public health care system.
Yes.
Where are we going? Where does this lead us?
In terms of what health care reform will do for us?
Yeah.
So it does a number of things, I think. You know, it's a large legislation with lots of detail. But, you know, I'll talk about some of the major things. So one of the major things it does is coverage expansion, which is just to say that in today's world, many people go without any health insurance. And as a consequence of health care reform as of 2014, virtually everybody, you know, upwards of 96 or 97% of the population will have health insurance, whether that is Medi-Cal or for children, Healthy Families, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program, or whether it's private insurance through the newly established insurance exchanges, where people will have an opportunity through business or through the companies they work for or themselves to get insurance. And so just many, many more people will have insurance. The second thing that healthcare reform does is it creates mental health parity, which means all of those insurances will include a mental health benefit that is equivalent to the healthcare benefit. Which means, you know, upwards of virtually everyone will have insurance, and that health insurance will include access to mental health care, which, again, is different than we have today. The second mm-hmm. set of sort of impacts is health insurance reform. So it requires guaranteed issuing and renewal, which means insurance companies won't be able to deny coverage because of a pre-existing condition, or because you get a condition and then when you go to renew, they won't be able to deny that renewal. It prohibits annual and lifetime limits, so there won't be limits on your health care coverage. And it covers kids. Young adults can automatically continue on their parents' coverage. Many of us know that that sometimes happens when our kids are in college. But the healthcare reform will ensure that that happens, you know, for all young adults can continue on their parents' insurance. The third thing it does is it redesigns how we do health care. And so it creates what's called an accountable care organization. Accountable care organizations are structures where hospitals, primary care physicians, and specialty care physicians, including mental health, all work in a coordinated way with accountability to outcomes being a priority. And that the driver of healthcare will be through what's referred to as person-centered healthcare homes, which is to say that all of us will have a physician who coordinates our care, makes sure we get all of our needs met, whether it's everyday medical problems or specialty healthcare problems, again, including our mental health care. And those person-centered medical homes are designed or will be designed to ensure collaboration in our treatment so that our treatment is done, so that we have a say in our treatment when we talk to our physicians. And then the last thing that healthcare reform does that's significant is it changes the way the healthcare is paid for. So it moves away from paying for each individual service. The way it works now, the more services that are provided, the more payments are made,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to move it towards payment for outcome. So there might be, just by way of example, there might be what's called an episode of care payment. Let's say I go to get my tonsils removed. Today, you pay the anesthesiologist, you pay the surgeon, you pay the nurse, you pay for the gauze, you pay for the hospital bed. Each thing you get in the hospital, you pay for. The more stuff you get,
the Sharpie that they marked your chart with.
Exactly,
yes.
And you see how they do that, right, with all of those, like, little stickers now that they scan. In the new system, there'll be one payment for having your tonsils removed, regardless of how much work the physicians and all of the healthcare providers have to do. And if it's more complicated, if there's a problem, if they have to give you extra treatment, there's no extra cost. So it creates an incentive for people to do the most effective treatment and get it right the first time, essentially evidence-based medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are the major, those are sort of the major impacts: more coverage, better access, reform. We can't lose our benefits, and our kids get covered. This coordinated care and payment reform.
How, you know, it sounds really encouraging, and How are all of the competing interests managed in this, though? Because, you know, we know insurance companies want to make money, and to do that, sometimes they have to kind of seem draconian to people who are trying to get health care. We know that the pharmaceutical industry is like a major traded stock and has a real obligation to their shareholders to share profits. We know that doctors, one of the reasons doctors become doctors is because they want to drive cool cars and live in fancy houses.
Not all of them, but
many, some. You know, it's one of the perks. And it should be, because it's a really important job, and it's a hard job, and there's lots of liabilities and concerns and all the other stuff that
mm-hmm.
goes along with it. Not to take anything away from them. And then there's us who want, you know, reliable health care, stuff that helps us to figure out stuff before it becomes a problem, stuff that gets fixed without causing us to become bankrupt. How does all this come together in this package to work for anybody?
So there's a great deal here to be done.
That's a big question. I'm sorry.
No, and the details have yet to be fully worked out. And so most of healthcare reform takes effect in 2014, increased coverage and many of the reforms, although a handful of the changes have already taken effect,
mm-hmm.
took effect in 2010, like coverage for your kids and like not having exclusions. But much of this is being developed, so there is a role for the public to participate in forums. There are what's referred to as Medicaid waivers, which take effect from now until 2014, a number of California counties are participating in waivers, which is a way to experiment with new payment provisions and new accountable care organization structures. There are new oversight bodies that have been created. There's websites that will have information about exchanges, allow us to see, as consumers, in a user-friendly kind of a way to compare insurance plans. So there's a variety of structures. But I think ultimately what folks talk about is flipping the triangle. In other words, what we do now is the bulk of our money is hospital and late-stage treatment. And what we and very little of our money really goes to promotion of health and prevention and early intervention. And we need to flip that so that we're promoting health, which means addressing things like obesity and cigarette smoking. And we need to have early intervention and prevention so that at the first signs of difficulty, people are seeing their doctor and getting conditions treated before they become serious and require more expensive, intrusive, and less ultimately helpful interventions. So less heroic surgery and more early intervention kinds of treatments. And that really is a shared sort of responsibility. It's not just the healthcare system that needs to look at that, but Americans in general need to take a look at our lifestyles and take a look at how we approach healthcare. Part of the reason we wait to the last minute to get treatment, and much of that treatment in emergency rooms, because we don't have health insurance to begin with. So by giving more people health insurance, people will have the opportunity to go early. The next thing that has to happen is we have to take advantage of that so that when we have that, you know, you get your periodic physical, you get your cholesterol checked, you take advantage of lifestyle improvement, you know, stop smoking cigarettes, and we do some of these things that we know are associated with better health outcomes.
And also for behavioral health, we're also looking at evidence-based programs that are prevention. Just like we're going to be implementing another program, and I think Scott's going to spearhead it, the EDIPP, which is...
That's an acronym, too.
Early Detection for the Intervention...
Early detection and intervention for prevention of psychosis.
Yes.
And that's exactly right. And behavioral health has a role in promoting mental health, which, you know, can involve things like reducing stress and learning to deal with conflict that are related to other health problems. But the EDIT program is unique because it really talks about preventing people from developing psychotic disorders, which you might think of as schizophrenia, or you might think of as bipolar, manic depressive disorder. And these disorders, which affect a relatively small number of people, if not treated well, can have very serious consequences and account for that statistic I mentioned earlier.
Yes.
People are so disabled by these disorders that they don't seek preventative health care. And disorders that most of us would get identified and treated early, cardiac problems and early cancers, don't get detected early in people with severe mental illness. So the EDIT program, which prevents and reduces the impairment associated with psychotic disorders, holds tremendous promise for improving both mental health and well-being and health and life expectancy.
Nice. So the theme today, then, is that in healthcare and I suppose in mental health care, is that identifying stuff early and accurately and then treating it with precise and clear and effective established treatments under some sort of monitoring thing ends up saving people and governments and taxpayers and not only money, but maybe tremendous amounts of suffering. And that's what good governance would maybe be about in terms of safety nets and in terms of healthcare. Does that sound about right, Todd?
I think that's completely right.
I think you got it right.
Well, we really appreciate what you're doing for us in terms of the support of the California Institute of Mental Health, and you know we appreciate being like identified as like a semi-model county. And really enjoy working with you. Thanks for coming aboard today.
Thank you. You guys are definitely a model county, and I appreciated the chance to join your radio show.
Well, here's the thing. Okay, so you're a connoisseur, right, of, like, mental health stuff, right? You're like Northern California. You know what vintage it is and everything. Would you send your friends and family down here for treatment? That's really the ultimate test, isn't it?
Knowing what I know about you guys, I would be very comfortable. I suspect that Imperial County Behavioral Health offers the best kind of mental health treatment that probably you can find, and certainly based on the programs you're implementing, and definitely the place I would send my family and friends.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you so much, Todd. Thank you so much for being here.
Have a good morning. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. That was Todd Sofna. He's the Deputy Director of California Institute of Mental Health, and we were so glad to have him here. And having, you know, he's one of, CIMH is the one that's, you know, promoting the and encouraging counties to implement evidence-based programs and talking about health care reform. Like you summed it up, Scott, you know, that's implementing those evidence-based programs is going to decrease costs and move towards health care reform.
And maybe kind of lower the level of suffering that people
yes.
have to do, you know,
yes.
which seems okay, too.
Yes. So.
All right. Well, join us next week for another exciting, fun-filled show on Let's Talk About It. And
we'll see you next week. We'll hear from you, hopefully, next week.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Let's Talk About It, heard each Thursday morning at 7:30 a.m. on KUBO 88.7 FM, Radio Bilingue. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.